A 1950s housewife is unhappy in her marriage and plans to run away from her husband. When she disappears one day, authorities find her hotel room stained in blood, leading some to suspect she was murdered. But was she? Or did she fake her own death? That's the basic premise of a book called Into Thin Air by author Harry Carmichael. The plot isn't totally original. There are plenty of novels with similar themes. Spouses running away from their marriages, evading a murder conviction, characters disappearing on purpose. The Hunt for Richard Thorpe by Gerard Tickle, for example, or John Updike's Rabbit Run. Others include Elizabeth Bowen's The Death of the Heart, Sylvia Ashton Werner's Incense to Idols, and Irving Wallace's The 27th Wife. But these books share something else in common besides their themes. Each one was checked out of a library in a 6-month period by a housewife who later went missing under circumstances that mirrored their plots. I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify Studios original. Every Thursday, I'll discuss a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, I'm talking about a housewife and a mother of two who disappeared from her suburban home in 1961. She left behind baffled neighbors, a blood-stained kitchen, and a mystery, the likes of which we may never see again. Her name is Joan Risch.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Money Maker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Money Maker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs. Drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
From the Journal, Trillion Dollar Shot. Find it in the Journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
It's the summer of 1961. Joan and Martin Risch are hosting a barbecue at their new house in Lincoln, Massachusetts, a small town about 20 miles outside of Boston. They moved in just a few weeks ago. But they're not throwing the party to get to know their new neighbors. Actually, Joan and Martin only invited their old friends from before the move, when they lived in Ridgefield, Connecticut. They never sent invites to anyone new, and the neighbors have noticed. They're not trying to be rude, necessarily. From everything I've gathered, the Risches are perfectly friendly. They're just not the type of people who go out of their way to make new connections. Joan's already declined an invitation to join the local church. She attended a meeting of the League of Women's Voters, but didn't really make a splash. One member of the group called her reserved but friendly. Another, not especially glamorous. So far, Joan's only socialized with a small handful of neighbors, like Barbara Barker, who occasionally babysits her two kids, and Mary Jane Butler, who lives down the street. One reason she and Martin chose their new house is because it's surrounded by a row of pine trees. It offers privacy, but Joan is also an avid gardener who loves nature and books. Every week, she visits the local library to check out novels, biographies, travel logs, and field guides. Basically anything she can get her hands on. Joan worked in the publishing industry on the Upper West Side of New York City for years before marrying Martin. They met through one of Joan's roommates and dated long distance for a bit while Martin finished his degree at Harvard. After tying the knot, Joan left her job and traded her red pens and typewriter for a broom and kitchen apron. Now her two kids keep her busy. The Rishes have a 4-year-old daughter named Lillian and a 2-year-old son named David. Joan handles most of the childcare, the cooking, the cleaning, and the majority of the housework. Martin works as a traveling salesman and is gone a lot, usually 4 or 5 days at a time. On October 24th, 1961, Martin is up before sunrise. He's out the door by 7 a.m. to catch a flight to New York, and Joan is still in bed. She spends most of the day in a flurry of errands, receiving occasional visitors: the mailman, the garbage man, and delivery guy. Some reports suggest Joan has casual talks with each one. "Hello, nice to see you. Thank you." That kind of thing. Like I said, she's nice. Around 9:30 a.m., Joan drops her son David off with Barbara Barker, the babysitter. Then Joan takes Lillian to a dentist appointment. Afterward, Joan shops for groceries, picks up David from Barbara's, and goes home to make lunch and put David down for his nap. While David's napping, Barbara's 5-year-old son Douglas drops by and asks if he can play with Lillian. Joan lets him in, and presumably the kids spend the early afternoon playing, either inside or in the backyard. Little David is still napping when, around 2 p.m., Joan sends Lillian and Douglas back to Barbara's house. Now, this is around the time when some of Joan's neighbors reportedly see Joan mowing her lawn. But that testimony has been disputed, so it's important that we take it with a grain of salt. Either way, at 2:15, Barbara glances out her window and sees Joan standing in her driveway. Joan's car is parked, and notably, Barbara doesn't see any other vehicles in the vicinity. Keep that in mind for later. Around 4 p.m. or shortly before, Barbara tells Lillian to head back home because she has some errands to run. Playtime's over. The houses aren't far apart. The 4-year-old makes the short trip home. But when she walks into the house, she finds the kitchen trashed. It's of course strange, but Lillian's too young to make sense of it all. So she carries on upstairs to go play. But soon enough, she hears her little brother crying and realizes she hasn't heard from her mother since she got back. So Lillian goes back to Barbara's house. By this point, Barbara's just getting back from her errands. And as soon as Lillian sees Barbara, she lets out a sentence that will forever be tied to this case. "Mommy isn't home, and there's red paint all over the kitchen floor." On the afternoon of October 24th, 1961, 4-year-old Lillian Risch tells her family's babysitter, Barbara Barker, that her mom is missing, and there's red paint all over the kitchen floor. What does Barbara do? She grabs two of her 3 children, the 6 and 4-year-old, leaves the youngest at home, and follows Lillian back to the Risch's house, completely unprepared for what they'll find. The phone receiver in the kitchen has been torn from the wall so that it's dangling on the rim of the garbage can. The table's been completely upended. Papers and books are strewn across the floor. And that so-called red paint? It's blood. Barbara calls out to Joan, but no one answers. She just hears David, the 2-year-old, crying upstairs. No one's taking care of him. After bracing herself, Barbara heads upstairs, grabs David, gathers the rest of the kids, and takes them back to the safety of her home. The first call she places is to another woman who lives on their street, Mary Jane Butler, who goes by Jane. And together, they go back to the Risch's house to search for Joan. Luckily, they don't touch anything and compromise the crime scene. They do peek in the bathrooms to see if Joan might have slipped in the shower and hit her head. They wander through the dark cellar, scour every room in the house, search the yard, but there's no sign of Joan. So Barbara calls the police. She and Jane also try to get in touch with Martin, but since he's traveling, it takes a while before his coworkers track down the hotel he's staying at in New York City. He doesn't hear the news until much later that night, around 11 p.m. and by all accounts, Martin is floored. He heads straight to the airport to book a flight home. Meanwhile, a police officer arrives at Joan's place. He takes a more detailed look at the blood and notices there's spatter arcing across the floor and a few smears on the wall. It leads him to believe Joan must have died by suicide. But the problem with that theory is there's no body. He calls for backup, and a massive search ensues. 80 other officers and 2 helicopters come in to canvass a 6-mile radius around Joan's home, but they don't find anything in the yard or in the woods, and no one fitting Joan's description has checked into any of the local hospitals. Other than the blood spatter and mess in the kitchen, the house looks mostly normal. There's no signs of forced entry. All that's missing is Joan's appointment book. Officials find hair in the kitchen that could be Joan's, as well as several fingerprints. The hair matches Joan's color, but this is well before the onset of DNA technology, so there's no way to confirm. As for the fingerprints, investigators eventually determine all but one belong to Martin. They test the outlier against Joan's friends, family, and neighbors, but they don't find a match. They even compare it to fingerprint records from a nearby military base and of convicted sex offenders. But still, nothing. If Joan had gone missing in the 21st century, police could have put the print in a database and compared it to thousands of records in an instant. But they can't even rule Joan out since they don't have her prints on file. They can, however, examine the blood. It's type O, same as Joan. About half a pint to a pint has been spilled throughout the home. For context, a pint is about the amount you lose when you donate blood. It's actually not enough to suggest Joan is dead or even in danger. And smears in the kitchen indicate someone tried to clean it up, but gave up. The full trail of blood runs through the kitchen and into multiple bedrooms upstairs, including David's nursery. It then travels outside and ends in the driveway. The police are baffled by the route. They can't make heads or tails of what Joan might have been doing. And if she was alone and bleeding that badly, why would she have stopped and tried to clean? To learn more, investigators question everyone in Joan's life. The milkman, the delivery guy, and of course, her neighbors. Apparently, throughout that summer, someone saw a blue-gray Oldsmobile parked in Joan's driveway a few different times. The car didn't belong to the Rishes or anyone else who lived on the street. At least no one they knew. The witness only remembers part of the car's license plate, so police can't look it up. It's unfortunate, because another resident, a teenage girl, tells them she saw the same make and model parked in front of Joan's house the day she disappeared. Timing-wise, that means the car pulled up sometime after 2:15, when Barbara saw Joan standing outside alone, and before the teenage girl got home from school, which would have been just after 3. And remember, Lillian returned home around 4 to a bloodstained kitchen. That's a relatively short time frame, and the mysterious car isn't the only indication that someone may have been keeping tabs on Joan. Another local tells police that an unidentified man called her on the phone recently, demanding information about Joan. Someone else says a stranger approached her on the street, again, asking where Joan was. There are other strange reports as well, like how apparently an anonymous person sent geraniums to Joan's house. Whether it's the same person driving the Oldsmobile or placing the calls, the police aren't sure, but they consider it notable nonetheless. Now, that's a lot to take in, and police gather all this information before Martin's flight lands at 1:12 a.m. on the 25th. Roughly 10 hours after Joan's disappearance. They share everything they know with him, and Martin seems genuinely surprised. He can't believe anyone would want to hurt Joan. He can't even name a single possible suspect. Investigators also don't think he seems guilty, or like he's hiding anything. He insists his marriage was happy, which comes as no surprise because several neighbors have already corroborated that fact. Still, the police are thorough. Surprisingly so. Gendered violence, like sexual assault and domestic abuse, is even more taboo and misunderstood in the 60s than it is today. You might expect the police to be overly trusting of Martin, but that's not the case. these Boston area officials know how common domestic homicide is. Several recent high-profile cases have driven that point home. According to author Stephen H. Ahern, in his book, A Kitchen Painted in Blood, for that reason, the lead detective working Jones' case takes an extra close look at Martin. They verify his alibi and confirm, yes, he really was in New York the day Joan disappeared. And they determine he had no motive to hire a hit person. Joan didn't come from wealth, and her life insurance policy was modest. Besides some run-of-the-mill gossip, there's no evidence that Joan and Martin dealt with infidelity or marital problems. Which is all to say, officials rule Martin out as a suspect pretty quickly, leaving them with no other leads, persons of interest, and a witness list that's shrinking by the hour. However, they could talk to Joan's daughter some more. Lillian told police that when her mother sent her out to play, there was a so-called strange man in their home. The four-year-old also says that her mom told her she was going out. The neighbor boy, Douglas, corroborates this information. He says there was a man in the living room that afternoon. He also claims Joan planned to travel to Logan Airport later that day. For what reason? Who knows? But his account gets confusing and contradicts some established facts, so it's easy to dismiss its credibility. We can't be sure, but it's entirely possible the police dismissed the kid's testimony entirely. Research indicates that child witnesses weren't really taken seriously until the 1980s, even though the evidence shows children can, in fact, provide credible testimony that sticks to the facts, so long as investigators make them feel safe and supported throughout the process and avoid confusing or upsetting them. Unfortunately for Joan, most of what we know about child psychology, and especially child witnesses, was discovered well after her disappearance. What might have changed if we knew more earlier? Well, we'll probably never know. But in the fall of 1961, the police aren't the only ones searching for answers to Joan's disappearance. Her case becomes big news and makes headlines all across the state. Within a few days, Martin hosts a press conference on his front lawn. But it doesn't go the way the press expects. One reporter kicks things off by asking what people can do to help Joan. Martin replies, "Try and find her." He then describes Joan's appearance and says, "That's all, gentlemen," before walking away. The whole thing lasts a total of 28 seconds. A description of the press conference appears in the Boston Globe. The reporter, Leonard Lerner, justifies Martin's behavior by saying he was obviously under great emotional stress. But that doesn't stop other reporters from continuing to hound him for more information. According to Martin, if he accepted every press inquiry, he'd never have a free minute. And even if he wanted to talk, he doesn't have much to share. Leads are drying up. Within a month, investigators are stumped. But at some point, a strange announcement makes its way to the public. Officials with the serology department, a group that studies blood composition, say they don't believe the blood at the Risch's home is consistent with an injury. According to them, it's more like menses. Now, the serology department walks this back pretty quickly. Their next statement is less certain. They say they can't really tell if the blood is from a wound or menstruation, which actually makes sense. Reliable tests for this sort of thing don't exist yet. Officials end up running a third test, but don't publish those results. Not that it really would have mattered. The damage is done. The suggestion that it was somehow period blood sends the rumor mill into overdrive, even though there's no evidence to support that statement. In fact, it's laughable on its face. Blood only makes up about half of menstrual fluid, and during a typical period, a person loses significantly less than a half pint of blood. But that doesn't stop friends, neighbors, and acquaintances from gossiping about how Joan's disappearance could have something to do with a miscarriage or a botched abortion. It's extremely frustrating, and a great example of how few women there were in law enforcement at the time. But the good news is, the police don't take any of the speculation seriously. Instead, they think the blood may have come from a head wound, or maybe someone hit Joan hard enough to trigger a nosebleed. In January 1962, 2 months after Joan's disappearance, a new detective takes over the case and reviews the evidence again. And this leads to a break in the case. After speaking with Joan's stepbrother, the detective learns that Joan's old elementary school used to fingerprint their students, and Joan's prints are still on file. Turns out that one strange print investigators found in the kitchen, it's not Joan's. Someone was with her that day. On April 10th, the district attorney releases the news to the public and finally voices some optimism. He says, quote, "It may take us months and months to get anywhere with this new information, but now we have something to go on." And he's right. It takes a long time. By early 1963, local journalist Serene Ruth Gerson isn't even thinking about Joan Risch when she heads to the Lincoln Library. Serene writes for a weekly paper, but she's not here for business. She's just looking for a good read and grabs a book called Into Thin Air by Harry Carmichael, the one I mentioned at the very top of this episode. When she goes to sign it out, she sees Joan Risch's name on the checkout card. Joan borrowed it about 5 months before she disappeared. It's a light bulb moment. Suddenly, Serene wants to get her hands on every book Joan checked out in the 6 months before she disappeared. She ends up with a list of 24 different titles. And like I said at the top of the episode, a significant portion are about characters running away or intentionally disappearing from their unhappy lives or marriages. There's even an autobiography of a forensic investigator who specifically handled missing persons cases. It's enough to make Serene wonder. Did Joan stage the crime scene in her kitchen? If you're anything like me, you're thinking to yourself, all those books that Joan checked out before she disappeared? It has to be a coincidence. Faking your own death? Carefully orchestrating a crime scene? That usually only happens in fiction. But when me and my team examined the evidence, the idea started to feel like a real possibility, at least enough to pull on the thread and see where it goes. And turns out, we're not the only ones who found it compelling. Back in 1962, the police seriously considered the theory too. See, there's a period of about 2 hours where we don't know Joan's whereabouts. She was last seen at 2:15 p.m. on October 24th, and her daughter reported her missing to the babysitter around 4:15 p.m. In that two-hour window, several people saw a woman matching Joan's description walking in the area. In fact, a cab driver picked up a woman who looked just like Joan. The woman seemed confused and kept changing her mind about where she wanted to go. She ran up a $5 fare and handed the cab driver a paper bag filled with cash. Later that day, two different drivers spotted a woman who could have been Joan, either hitchhiking or walking alongside the road, one on Route 2A, the other on Route 128. On Route 128, the woman apparently had a bloodied leg. Now, as Stephen H. Ahern laid out in his book, they happened 5 to 6 miles away from each other, and only 35 to 40 minutes apart. It's unlikely Joan could have covered that distance on foot in such a short time frame, unless someone gave her a ride. And no one ever comes forward saying they did. Still, police investigate the sightings anyway. They don't find any blood along those roads, or witnesses to verify the sightings, and tracking dogs never pick up Joan's scent. But because officials never confirm the identity of the women sighted, they can't totally rule out the possibility that one was Joan. And if only one of them was her, that could mean she disappeared on purpose. The question is, why would she have wanted to? According to her husband Martin, Joan was happy. She loved her children and would never abandon them. He claimed that the only way Joan would leave them is if she literally forgot, as in she suffered a bout of amnesia after a head injury or something. And others seem to agree. An old family friend said that Joan, quote, lived for nothing but her home, husband, and children. But according to another one of Joan's friends, her generosity may have come at a personal cost. They wondered whether she ever really enjoyed herself, because she spent so much time trying to make things perfect for family. Perhaps because her own childhood was far from perfect. Joan was orphaned at the age of 8 when her parents died in a tragic apartment fire. Her aunt and uncle, Alice and Frank Natras, then took her in. And while she was in their care, her uncle, who became her stepfather, reportedly sexually abused her. I don't know many details about the alleged abuse, But over the years, Joan opened up to the people in her life about what happened to her. Her stepbrothers, her roommates in New York, her husband Martin. And notably, she wrote a letter to her stepmother Alice that alluded to the abuse, just 3 weeks before she went missing. Now, unfortunately, that letter didn't survive long. Alice destroyed it shortly after receiving it, maybe because she found the content so disturbing. But to her credit, Alice didn't hide the information from the police. She told investigators about what Joan had written, saying the alleged abuse happened when Joan was 13 or 14 years old, and went on for a while. But does a painful past drive someone to run away from a happy present? When investigators pursue that possibility, they find very little evidence to suggest she did. Joan would have needed a way to support herself, and she already had experience in publishing, but no one fitting her description ever applies or interviews for a relevant job. And if Joan did do a whole bunch of research to fake her own disappearance, she could have staged the crime scene to be a lot less confusing. As former FBI agent Mark Safrick explained in author Stephen Ahern's book, it wouldn't make sense for her to try to clean up her blood or hang the phone receiver on the edge of the trash can. Not if she wanted people to think she'd been murdered or kidnapped. And why would she have taken her appointment book? Thanks to her daughter's testimony, which was corroborated by that fingerprint, we know someone was with her in the kitchen that day. That, plus the strange man asking neighbors about her, the anonymous flowers arriving on her doorstep, the car that no one recognized periodically dropping by the house that summer, everything besides those library books seems to point to foul play. Maybe Joan was just an avid reader who loved mystery and crime, and her tragic history holds the answer to who may have wanted to harm her. Several of Joan's relatives have hinted that they could see her stepfather, Frank Natras, making Joan disappear. Joan had just written that letter, and apparently he had a reputation for having a temper, and for intimidating and controlling his family. At one point, Martin even told investigators that he thought Frank was responsible for Joan's disappearance. Now, Frank Natras denied ever hurting Joan. He disputed her allegations of sexual abuse and insisted he had nothing to do with her going missing. And he allegedly had an alibi for October 24th, 1961. Which may be why Frank Natras was never arrested or charged with any crime related to Joan's disappearance. He died a free man 9 years later in 1970. As for Martin, for years after his wife's disappearance, he insisted she must have suffered a bout of amnesia. He held out hope that maybe one day she would somehow recover her memories and return home. He never changed his phone number or moved away from the neighborhood in case she did. He stayed there, waiting, until the day he died. Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to finish this episode, 30 people disappeared in the United States alone. For more information on Joan Risch's case, we found A Kitchen Painted in Blood, The Unsolved Disappearance of Joan Risch by Stephen Ahern, especially helpful to our research. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify Studios originals for free on Spotify. Disappearances is a Spotify Studios original. Our head of programming is Julian Boireau. Our supervising sound designer is Russell Nash, with Nick Johnson as our head of production, and Spencer Howard as our post-production supervisor. Allie Wicker is our supervising editor, and Derek Jennings is our writing lead. This episode was written by Angela Jorgensen, edited by Natalie Pertzofsky and Connor Sampson, researched and fact-checked by Chelsea Wood, produced by Alex Button, with sound design by Alex Button. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.